coming back to flying, just, you know, the first flight I flew with Chris, the military had given Air Ability some funding for veterans. I'd been offered it about 2 years before, and I just didn't have the confidence. And then Liz, who used to work for Air Ability, who did one of these talks, she was looking after the veterans thing, and emailed me and said, "Look, come in, you know, have a go." And I did. Anyway, it was amazing. And you know, Mike and the others at Air Ability just said it. I said, "Well, I'm never going to be able to fly. You know, I'm on antidepressants, and I'll never get a medical. And I love it, and I just don't know if this is just going to be too hard." And they just said, "Does it matter? You love it. You love being in the air. Clearly, it makes you happy. Just do it. And if you always have to have an adaption, which for you, and you know, I don't have physical disability, your adaption is going to potentially be always having a qualified pilot with you. Doesn't matter, does it? You'll still get to fly, still get to do it." And then in the end, actually, I worked with an AME, and he said, "Look, listening to your story, you know, you lost that thing you were passionate about, that dream when you were young. And clearly it is, you know, you're so enthusiastic now. I actually think instead of flying being dangerous because of your mental health," he said, "I believe it will improve your mental health." So to have somebody say that to me was huge.
From adversity to success, you have control. I'm Harriet Pound, and this is the Inspirability Podcast.
So I really enjoyed physiotherapy. I did that for, once I qualified, I worked in the NHS for about 4 years. And then I, you know, got to 29 and a half and hit that, oh my goodness, I'm going to be 30. What is my life and where am I going?
Turn into a pumpkin.
Yeah.
No, overnight.
Yeah. So I kind of threw everything up in the air and thought, I need to change. I don't know why. I mean, did I need to change? No, I didn't. I was perfectly good as I was and doing a good job with nice hours and, you know, a nice lifestyle. But itchy feet, I suppose. And also, I guess, in the back of my mind, I always wanted this exciting life, flying in the military. And I still had a few hang-ups about not being in the military anymore, not going and deploying on operations. So I just decided to apply for lots of random stuff. I applied for medical school, veterinary school, like an accountancy program with PwC, MI5, and it was an airline cadetship program. Because I just thought, well, I'll just put everything out there and see what happens. I got a place at medical school and kind of felt that that was a privilege and the other things would be cool, but maybe this was kind of a bit more of my calling and it was always what my parents wanted me to do and it would be a challenge, which is what I wanted. Because to keep me away from getting too stuck in my head and thinking about negative stuff or ruminating, I find it motivating to have a goal and have a kind of a pathway. So, you know, whether it's training for your PPL or whether it's training at university for 3 years or medical school or whatever it is, or a project or a hobby or, you know, doing up a house. Having something that I know this is my focus for a period of time helped. So signing up to medical school for 5 years and then knowing it was at least another 5 years before I'd qualify in anything, if not a lot longer, depending on the speciality. So that felt sort of comforting in a way, that I had this kind of pathway and therefore I had a role and an identity, because I'd always fixated on, you know, when I was younger, RAF. That is me. That's who I am. As opposed to me being me and that being a job. Medical school. Like I say, I was 30 when I went. It was a complete privilege to be there because, you know, I wasn't working. I was learning and, you know, fascinating really fascinating stuff. It was good. I got drawn back towards the military, like I alluded to before. I still had a bit of a chip, a hang up about losing my military career. And by this point, it took about 3 years for my back to fully recover. But I'd got back to a point, through endless exercises, physio, Pilates type stuff. I got back to a point that my back had improved. In fact, some of that was due, I joined a circus, whole other thing, but there was a local circus and they did training. So I trained in trapeze and aerial kind of stuff.
There's Pilates and then there's trapeze. I mean, that's...
Yeah, well, yes. And there's swinging from a trapeze at the top of a massive
Incredible.
Church roof.
Would you recommend that as a physio to any of your
Totally, absolutely.
Patients?
I had a mild shoulder injury at one point and it just was fantastic. It was, no amount of exercise got rid of it until you did like real big strength stuff for your shoulders, bilateral. And yeah, sorted that out. And got rid of my fear of heights. Because I used to fly, but I was always kind of scared of heights. But yes, so that sorted my back out. And then I took up running and so I got physically fit again. I just thought, I wonder, would I be able to get back into the military? So I applied for the TA. My local TA, and chatted to them and found out that we could just transfer my commission across because it was just under the 5 years since I'd left, which meant I could be paid have a proper role. So I did that first year at medical school. I joined the Royal Army Medical Corps, but got seconded across to the officer training, Cardiff Company Officer Training Corps, to be a 2IC. And help run their thing. I did it for a year. It wasn't my favourite job. Cadets were lovely, but I wanted to be doing medical stuff. So I went back to do medical things with the local field hospital for the second year. And then thought about getting sponsored for the last 3 years of medical school, because with my third time at university, it was getting expensive. And I looked at all three services and ended up in the army. Probably not my wisest choice, but it was the choice I made at the time because I wanted to be a surgeon and that was the route to doing that. And it kind of inspired by what was going on in Afghanistan at the time. So yes, joined the regular army through the last few years of medical school.
How did you find combining your time in the army with your time at medical school, to balancing the two, that sort of work-life balance?
Actually, not difficult, because they were very focused on us just getting through and passing. I think, they almost discouraged you from doing too much. You had opportunities within, to go and do some attachments with the army or things, but they actively encouraged you just to focus on your studies and pass. So that there wasn't a delay to finishing training and having to repeat. And in fact, they encouraged you all to leave the OTC. So, or the TA, had to resign from that. So I found that a bit tricky, because actually the last 3 years I was very much away from the military, whereas the first 2 years with the TA, or the Army Reserve as it is now, I loved that. I love being part of that team.
So when you finished your training, when you finished your medical school, did you then go into the army full time?
Yeah, so well, I got posted to Portsmouth, which is how I've ended up living in Gosport. I got posted down there to do my foundation year training, so the 2 years that all junior doctors do. We in the military had to work at one of the hospitals that had, at the time, the kind of the military unit attached to them, so like Birmingham or Frimley Park or Plymouth or Portsmouth. So I came to Portsmouth because I like sailing and I like being by the sea. And when I left the RAF, I'd you know, apart from going to physio school, I'd got myself into sailing and thrown myself at that and done, I did it like a four, while I was leaving on my resettlement, I did like a 4-month sailing course to just try and focus on something and become something else.
Did you do a yacht race as well, do you remember you saying?
Yeah, later on.
Later on, we'll talk about that later on. So talk to me a little bit about that finding your identity, because you had a dream to join the Air Force. You had an identity, like you alluded to earlier, that you were in the Air Force as opposed to that was your job. And then the rug was pulled from under your feet. And then you were trying to find another identity or another role. How did you, at what point do you feel that you actually found who you were and you figured out your identity?
Am I allowed to say I'm still looking? No.
Absolutely.
It took a while after Lee, you know, I kind of always saw myself as a military then. And so I'd kind of, you know, just sort of shifted it to the army. I always felt like I was RAF, just sort of as a fraud in the army, because I could kind of identify with them more. But I think once I left the army, you know, that was, you know, I left with mental, with recurrent depression, essentially, and, you know, some trauma stuff. But yeah, I learned through a lot of support and therapy and stuff when I was leaving the army and after, to kind of finally accept myself as civilian and not be frightened of that. And, you know, identify, you know, very much as a doctor now and an NHS doctor. But one of the big things for me, I tried, you know, you talked about sailing, or you asked about sailing. I tried lots of stuff when I was leaving the army, because I had a year off sick, to try and, yeah, find me again and find what I was passionate about. And I did some mountaineering. So I went on a British Legion expedition up climbing Mira Peak in Nepal. And I thought, you know, what did I learn from that? Some valuable lessons, but one of them was I'm not a mountaineer and I don't particularly like being hypoxic at altitude. But I learned about, you know, taking things slowly, just being patient. But importantly, I learned about saying no and saying, actually, I don't want to do that. And even though everybody's telling me, come on, do it. You know, it's really hard, do it. And that's how I lived my life. If it was hard, I was doing it. If there was the hard, what was the easiest path? What was the hardest path? I was always picking the hardest path. If I was scared of it, that's how I was going to do it. Because as a child, I was like, I don't want to ever be scared of anything. If you're scared of it, just keep doing it until you're not scared of it. And that works, but it makes life challenging because you're always stressing yourself. And I kind of learned that that wasn't healthy. So Nepal was really good because I found it, you know, the day before the summit, I found it really hard. I was on the glacier, attached lots of people on ropes. You know, you can't breathe as well because the oxygen essentially is lower at altitude. And that stimulates what feels very like a panic attack. So, you know, it's not, but it feels similar symptoms to it being like that. And I was just there and I thought, I'm safe, you know, I'm with a team and everything's fine, but this feeling is horrible. I don't like it and I don't want this. And I suddenly had this kind of flashback to feeling those kind of feelings of panic when I was at work, and I'd been working in A&E prior to becoming unwell again and being off for that year. And it dawned on me that actually, I think at that point, I'd rather be in A&E on a busy night shift because I can just walk out for 5 minutes, you know, calm down and walk back in again. It doesn't, you know, I have that control. So it was the first time in a long time that I kind of was able, I decided to say no rather than telling myself it was a failure. Now, on that trip, we had some lovely professional mountaineers who were also trained as coaches. So they were very supportive around that. But it allowed me to do that. And so the next, you know, when we were going for the summit the next day, and some people couldn't because they weren't well enough and they had altitude sickness. And in fact, only three people actually made it. Some of the others didn't. I chose not to attempt it because I knew, one, I probably wasn't going to make it. And two, I didn't want to put myself in that. And that was a huge learning experience for me because I said no. I knew I was being judged by some of my colleagues, possibly, thinking, why did you even come here if you're not going to do that? But it was that whole journey, and that got me back to work. That got me coming home and going, actually, I think I can do that. And that was massive. And it was just accepting myself. You know, it's not about other people. It's just accepting that I can choose things that are good for me, and I don't always have to choose to put myself into a really panicky situation. And also that if I am in a really stressful situation and all the emotions build up and it feels like I'm going to have a panic attack or collapse or cry, it's okay. I can just stop, take a bit of time out. And actually, most people are pretty cool about it. You know, they'll just say, it's okay, just take 5 minutes.
So that importance of saying no that you touched on is something that I think is really valuable to a lot of our viewers and listeners, and well, and to me as well, you know, because I think we do feel really pressurized sometimes to say yes to things when perhaps we shouldn't be saying yes. So just tell me a little bit about why you think it's important to say no, and what advice you give to viewers and listeners about how to say no when they feel like they should be saying yes, but really saying no is the right thing for them to do. Because it's hard.
It is hard. It is hard. And there is a, you know, over the last few years, I think there's been a culture of, and this really encouraging, say yes more. Say yes to all these new opportunities. Be adventurous. Say yes. And I think, you know, that's really important. And that has done me well in a lot of ways. But it's about getting a balance, isn't it? And I'm, you know, it was with support and learning, reading, coaching, to learn to develop my assertiveness and self-confidence to say, that sounds a great opportunity, but it's not for me. Or thank you for inviting me to that. But, you know, I'd like to, you know, I don't want to come tonight, or I don't want to do that. And realizing that it's not offending other people, and it's not about pleasing other people, and it's just about being you, and being assertive isn't about being harsh. It's just saying, this is what's happening, this is how I feel, and this is, you know, this is what I'm going to do. And yeah, and not, you know, asking myself, will this bring me joy, or will this bring me benefit? Is this a good opportunity for me? And if it's not, just saying thank you, but no thank you.
I think for me, it was when I had my second child with my daughter, I realised just how limited my time was. And saying, I'd been saying yes to things because I wanted to help out, you know, friends, neighbours, whatever. And then realising that I was taking away from the time I was spending with my children, my family, and thought, is, like you said, is this actually benefiting me? So to talk about, tell us a bit about your, you said about developing assertiveness and self-confidence. What tools do you use to do that perhaps you can share with us?
I think some of it has been, you know, looking at like online resources, reading up about how to have difficult conversations, and how to express assertiveness without coming across as being blunt or, you know, winding somebody up, you know, on the defensive or something like that. I had quite a lot of good conversations around assertiveness and learning to express myself in a better way, through counselling, through like I said, some coach I had, like I spent some time with a couple of life coaches. And then some of the confidence stuff. I mean, one of my big confidence things was my, you know, what happened whenever I got involved with Air Ability, because I think I had got to a place where I felt a bit of imposter syndrome. I mean, I was a doctor, I am a doctor, but felt imposter syndrome about that. You know, I had been in the army, and I'd been in the army for 7 years, but I hadn't gone to Afghanistan, so I didn't have that medal. I felt like a fraud. I'd been in the Air Force and been flying, but I'd never got to the final aircraft, because my flying career got cut pretty, very short. So I kind of felt a bit of a fraud for that. And it was having, it was, you know, getting involved with Air Ability allowed me to kind of complete some of the kind of the open-ended things. And I remember somebody said to me about, you know, how do you find contentment? How do you find happiness, joy, whenever, as you get older? And they said, go back to the things that you find you were passionate about as a child. Now, if that was doing cartwheels, you know, go and do gymnastics. If that was dancing, go and join a dance class, or learn salsa or ballroom dancing. If that was flying, you know, go back to that. Whatever it was, like silly things, climbing trees, you know, get out there in nature and do those things, because if they really grabbed you as a child, we don't lose that kind of childishness. For some of us, it's a little bit more on the outside than others, but we've all got it inside. And I loved climbing trees. So when I did the circus stuff, hanging upside down by your feet on a rope just makes you giggle. And coming back to flying, just, you know, the first flight I flew with Chris, the military had given Air Ability some funding for veterans. And I'd been offered it 2 years before, and I just didn't have the confidence to come along, and I thought it would be triggering. I thought it would open up a whole can of worms. I just didn't know what way it was going to go. And then Liz, who used to work for Air Ability, who did one of these talks, she was looking after the veterans thing, and emailed me and said, look, come in, you know, have a go. And I did. Anyway, it was amazing. And you know, Mike and the others at Air Ability just said it. I said, well, I'm never going to be able to fly. You know, I'm on antidepressants and I'll never get a medical, and I love it, and I just don't know if this is just going to be too hard. And they just said, does it matter? You love it. You love being in the air. Clearly it makes you happy. Just do it. And if you always have to have an adaption, which for you, and, you know, I don't have physical disability, your adaption is going to potentially be always having a qualified pilot with you. Doesn't matter, does it? You'll still get to fly, still get to do it, but you'll just have to make a different change. And I don't know why I didn't think of that myself, but it was a kind of a lightning moment of, oh, okay, I can do this. A bit different, but I can do it. And then in the end, actually, I worked with an AME who we talked about mental health and medications and the impact of that on flying and licenses. We talked about German wings and that, you know, incident, because mental health isn't talked about in the general public much. Aviation world, it's talked about less. And he was wonderful, because he said to me, you know, the German wings thing, actually, we want pilots and to be able to talk about their mental health more, because that incident was somebody who was scared to talk about it over losing their career, and their mental health deteriorated and obviously led to that, you know, awful situation. And he said, look, listening to your story, you know, you lost that thing you were passionate about, that dream when you were young. And clearly it is, you know, you're so enthusiastic now. I actually think instead of flying being dangerous because of your mental health, he said, I believe it will improve your mental health. So to have somebody say that to me was huge.
It's very powerful, isn't it?
Yeah. So he worked with me, he said, you know, it's going to take 6 months-ish. We need to get you off that med. So you need to swap these ones to something else. You're going to have to work with CAA psychiatry and be assessed and stuff. But it's possible. It's not necessarily going to happen, but it's possible. If all the stars align, it's possible. So that gave me a focus. And that in itself has really benefited my mental health because it makes me look after me more. And, you know, you have life hits us with, you know, wobbles. And whereas I could easily kind of fall back into, oh, I don't feel great. I'm not cooking tonight. I'm not going to take my medication. It doesn't, because I just go back to what is this for? This is for flying.
So it's that underpinning that, it's that reason to do something, to be better, to...
Because it brings me joy. And luckily it's not something like tennis, because if it was, I wouldn't necessarily have to look after my mental health. But because it's for flying, I have to be careful and I have to look after me. So it's an ongoing battle. And I think it always will be for me with recurrent depression. But, you know, I'm staying stable through keeping this as, you know, my passion.
Thank you for listening. Remember to tune into the next episode of Inspirability. Subscribe to our channel to find all of our previous episodes and new releases.